morning, which is Pierce v. Pierce.
May it please the Court, Adam Nadelhaft for Petitioner-Appellant Joseph Price. This case is about federal courts allowing the state of Illinois to decide the merits of a crucial collateral attack on an underlying conviction before an inmate must make a federal habeas petition. The AEDPA has a one-year statute of limitations, but it calls for the statute of limitations to be told when a properly filed application for post-conviction or other collateral relief is made. And the Supreme Court in Duncan v. Walker and Carey v. Safford held that a state statute does not need to be called a post-conviction motion to be considered a collateral motion. The Court said, actually, the Congress may have refrained from exclusive reliance on the term post-conviction so as to leave no doubt that the tolling provision applies to all types of state collateral review available after a conviction and not just to those denominated post-conviction. And Duncan also held that the tolling provision in the AEDPA was designed to, quote, promote the exhaustion of state remedies by protecting a state prisoner's ability to later apply for federal habeas relief while state remedies are being pursued. And in addition, Duncan also said that the tolling provision was there to promote comity, that it would be unseemly in our dual system of government for a federal district court to upset a state conviction without an opportunity for the state courts to correct the violation. And the Fifth Circuit, in Hudson v. Quarterman, held that Texas's DNA statute told the statute of limitations under the AEDPA following Duncan v. Carey. In particular, it said, quote, Texas has enacted a right to DNA reexamination. The state has decided to impose a potential disruption to the finality of its own cases in order to better protect the wrongfully accused. Comity, therefore, dictates that the federal courts give Texas courts the time to review these DNA claims and provide necessary relief without forcing convicted persons to choose between the two systems, thereby undermining the remedy the Texas legislature has provided. And the same should be applied to Illinois' DNA statute, 116.3. Illinois' DNA statute is not simply a discovery motion, but rather an attack on the judgment. The title of the motion, of the statute itself shows that it's more than just a discovery motion. It's called a motion for fingerprint integrated ballistic identification system or forensic testing not available at trial regarding actual innocence. And it's a heavy burden that an applicant must meet in order to gain access to this DNA, to test the DNA. It's not like a simple discovery motion. The court must first determine whether identity was the key issue in the conviction and whether the DNA testing would be materially relevant to the defendant's assertion of actual innocence. And the Illinois Supreme Court in People v. Johnson held that this test requires that a trial court review the entirety of the trial as well as the as well as what the person wants to make a DNA test for in order to determine whether it will be materially relevant and he can get access to this DNA. And the Supreme Court of Illinois also, in People v. Savory, held that materially relevant means that the claim, the test must be, will it significantly advance the petitioner's claim of actual innocence? And this is, again, a fundamentally different test than a Rule 26 motion. And the legislative history has also confirmed that the statute was enacted for the purpose of exonerating the wrongfully accused. Representative Peter Roskam, the sponsor of the statute, stated that the purpose of the statute was, quote, an attempt to make sure that if science can exonerate someone, that science does exonerate them. And the Illinois Supreme Court in People v. LaPointe specifically identified a motion under 116.3 as a collateral attack on judgment. In that case, the court listed four types of collateral motions that LaPointe had made against his conviction. They were a federal habeas petition, a state habeas petition, a motion under Illinois' Post-Conviction Act, and a 116.3 motion. There's no dispute that the first three types of motions are collateral motions, and the same should be true for a 116.3 motion.
Well, now, Price could have protected his habeas claim by filing within the limitations period and then asking for a stay in federal court while a state motion for forensic testing was pending, right? That's one approach.
That was an approach discussed by the Supreme Court in Pace. I will say that that case was 4 years after Mr. Price could have made his motion. And I also would suggest that the federal courts probably don't want all these protective state motions before an inmate must exhaust his claims.
Because it would be pending here in federal court probably for a long time.
This case actually took almost seven years, for the Illinois courts to decide whether Mr. Price should get the DNA testing. So it would be pending. It could be pending for, in this case, up to 7 years before Mr. Price would make a motion for federal habeas. And other state DNA tests have been found to, courts in other states have found that other states' DNA tests toll the statute of limitations. As I mentioned before, the Fifth Circuit held that Texas's DNA statute tolled the statute of limitations.
And that statute is very similar to ours.
That statute is very similar. And the District of Delaware held that Delaware's DNA testing tolled the statute of limitations. And in People v. Price, this case, but a state court decision, the court mentioned that Delaware's DNA statute was based on Illinois statute.
So why don't you give us your bottom line on why we shouldn't adopt the 11th Circuit's approach?
Well, I think the 11th Circuit missed a crucial point here in that what you're looking at when you're looking at whether it's a collateral motion or not is whether a person is making a fundamental attack on his underlying conviction. And here, a trial court must look at the trial in its entirety and the DNA being tested before it can decide. And so it's looking at the propriety of the conviction before it'll even grant whether Mr. Price or anybody would get his DNA tested. In addition, there is a case that I didn't cite in my papers. It's called People v. Dodds, and I will write a supplemental letter and allow, obviously, the other side to respond. But
how do you spell that?
D-O-D-D-S.
Okay.
And that is 801 Northeast 2nd 63. It's a 2003 case. And they're dealing with the outcome of a 116.3 test. And they found that if DNA evidence is truly exculpatory, a defendant's conviction should be vacated and the defendant should be released, or some other similar resolution should be had. And that's on page 68 of that case. So there it was suggesting that no other motions need to be made once if the DNA testing is truly exonerates an inmate. And based on the Fifth Circuit and Hudson, and based on what I've said before, I believe that a motion under 116.3 should have told the statute of limitations. And unless there's any other questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Retha Stotts. I'm with the Office of the Illinois Attorney General, and I represent the respondent. Some of what the petitioner just said is right, but he is wrong on one key point. He seems to be saying that a 116.3 motion allows a prisoner to litigate a state law claim of actual innocence. That's not true. It is possible for an Illinois prisoner to challenge his conviction based on actual innocence. That's a claim under the Due Process Clause of the Illinois Constitution. If the prisoner can show that newly discovered evidence makes it probable that the result in the event of a retrial would be different, he is entitled to a new trial. But the mechanism for litigating an actual innocence claim is not a 116.3 motion. That has to be litigated in a post-conviction petition under Illinois' Post-Conviction Hearing Act. And that's clear, the difference between that claim and the 116.3 motion. It's clear just as a matter of logic. When the court is ruling on a 116.3 motion, it couldn't possibly also rule on whether the petitioner has shown actual innocence because the court doesn't have the test results yet. That's the whole purpose of the motion. The petitioner wants the test results. And even aside from that logical matter, it's clear as a matter of Illinois law, under the text of the statute and all of the cases interpreting it, that the 116.3 motion is different from the actual claim of actual innocence that has to be raised in a post-conviction petition. The text of the statute says if the petitioner meets the standard, the court can grant the testing. It doesn't say the court can invalidate the conviction, doesn't say the court can order a new trial, doesn't say the court can order the petitioner's release from custody.
Do you see any meaningful distinction between the Hudson situation, which is based on the Texas statute, and the Illinois statute? In other words, what is a meaningful distinction between these two statutes?
There is one key difference. The Hudson is based on the Texas statute, which is very different from Illinois. Under the Texas statute, once the court grants the DNA testing, there are automatically further proceedings. When the results come back, the court is required to automatically hold a hearing, consider the test results, and determine whether the result at a retrial would likely be different given those results. Not only that, the court can then also, if it finds that the result would likely be different, the court can release the prisoner on bail pending further proceedings. There is nothing comparable in Illinois' procedure. You know, the only thing that happens in the 116.3 is the court grants the testing, yes or no, and that's the end of it. The petitioner wants anything else to happen based on those results, he has to file a post-conviction petition.
Even though, as you point out, it's not related to post-conviction, it can trigger post-conviction relief.
It could be followed by a post-conviction. It could be made in the context of a post-conviction petition. It can be done in any number of ways, but the only way to invalidate the conviction under Illinois law is to file the post-conviction petition raising the claim of actual innocence.
So there's no time limit or anything in terms of once you get the results, unless, say, there are results that are favorable to you. Under Illinois law, you just bring whatever you think the appropriate motion is or the post-conviction proceeding.
Right.
In other words, there's no time triggering or anything going on in the Illinois statute.
No.
And you think that's a big enough of a difference? That we should not go with the Fifth Circuit's view of that statute? Because that's what we're trying to get to, you know, whether to go with the 11th Circuit or the Fifth Circuit.
Right. Well, there is that key difference that Illinois doesn't allow any further proceedings. Nothing else flows from the 116.3 motion itself. But even aside from that, Hudson just got the question wrong as a matter of Texas law anyway. Even under Texas law, the DNA motion is brought under Chapter 64. The only way to invalidate a conviction under Texas law is a separate habeas corpus proceeding under Article 11. We cited a couple of cases in the brief. There's the Baker case and the Tooley case. They're very clear on saying that, you know, whatever happens in the Article 64 DNA testing procedure, that can't invalidate the conviction. That still has to be a separate proceeding, a habeas corpus proceeding under a different provision of Texas law. So that's another reason that Hudson is wrong. The decision based on the Florida case, which is pretty similar to Illinois, reached the right result. The petitioner is also cited to a couple of district court cases. Those aren't on point at all. Those didn't involve a pure discovery standalone motion like the kind that was involved here. So they don't say anything either way. Petitioner also mentioned the legislative intent behind this statute. If all he's saying is that the intent was that Illinois prisoners would be able to get access to new scientific methods that might help them get evidence that might exonerate them, that's true. That was the intent. But if petitioner is saying that the intent was for 116.3 itself to function that way, he hasn't introduced any support for that. And even if that was the intent, that's not the statute that was enacted. The text of the statute is clear that all that can happen under 116.3 is granting the testing motion. Petitioner also mentioned the LaPointe case. He's over-reading that case. This is one sentence in a background discussion in that case, which dealt with a totally different issue of a successive post-conviction petition. And even in that sentence, the court didn't say that a 116.3 motion is a collateral attack. It just mentioned a 116.3 motion in the same general discussion as some other collateral attacks. Petitioner also suggested that he couldn't have asked for a protective stay prior to the Pace decision. That's not true. This court has held since at least Fernandez v. Stearns, which was in 2000, which was before this petitioner's federal petition was due, that a petitioner could file a protective federal petition ahead of time and seek a stay.
And that would be the process that you think makes more sense under the Illinois statute and looking at generally at federal habeas law, filing this protective stay.
That would be one way to do it. If the petitioner had actually litigated a claim of actual innocence, he would be doing it in a post-conviction petition. That would stay, or that would toll the federal limitations period anyway. So that would be one way to do it too. He wouldn't need to seek a stay. But to the extent he was maybe wasn't sure whether he would get tolling, he could certainly have sought the stay. The Illinois cases are clear that the 116.3 procedure is different from the post-conviction petition alleging actual innocence. The relief for those two procedures is different. One gives you testing. The other gives you a new trial. And the standards are different. The discovery standard is just a minimal standard. It's the scientific potential standard. Does the testing the petitioner seeks have the scientific potential to result in relevant evidence? In addressing that standard, the court doesn't even look to the probability that the result will be favorable to the defendant. Then the actual innocence standard under post-conviction, of course, the evidence must be favorable, and he must show that it would likely result in a different result if he were retried. So I would encourage the court to look at the Rokita and Price decisions. Those clearly explain the difference between the two procedures. Because the 116.3 itself can't invalidate the conviction as a matter of Illinois law, it simply cannot be a collateral attack. And that means the district judge was correct in finding that it didn't toll the statute of limitations. Unless there are more questions, I'd ask the court to affirm the judgment.
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Just a couple of points. One, the test to get DNA testing is not that a court must look at is not an easy test, as I mentioned before. When they're looking at whether DNA testing is granted, they must determine if the DNA test would come out to be favorable to the inmate, will it significantly advance his claim of actual innocence? The court in People versus Savory, as the Supreme Court actually, when it put out that test, found that Savory wasn't able to get the DNA testing because what he wanted to be tested wouldn't significantly advance his claim, that the genes he wanted tested was collateral, a kind of a side issue, and so it didn't grant it, and so it's not an easy test to get DNA, to even get the DNA evidence tested. The court looks at the trial as a whole and what is being asked to be reviewed, and then determines whether it would significantly advance the inmate's claim of actual innocence. The Texas decision cited a number of Texas cases that found that a motion under Texas's DNA statute was a collateral attack on judgment, and it cited three of those cases in its decision, and which are cited in my papers. Unless there's any other questions.
I don't believe so. Mr. Nadelhoff, you took this case by appointment, did you not?
Yes, I did.
The court, as I have earlier, thanks you for accepting the appointment and vigorously representing your client. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.